here we are again. Did you miss us?
I feel I haven't seen you for ages, Sales.
It's been just too long, I'm afraid.
We should do this more often.
I do believe that we left off with our heroine in New York.
It just took me a while to cotton on there. I'm like, I've never had heroin in New York.
So, yes,
you were in New York. Barbara Streisand, Bette Midler.
So one of the other absolute highlights of the trip.
Straight back onto you.
It's me.
Enough about me.
One of the absolute highlights of the trip, and I'm not going to say the only moment, but certainly a moment where I really, really, really wished you were there.
Yeah.
Was that we ate at Blue Hill. Which is episode two of Chef's Table. Mm-hmm. Now, just to fill in people who may not have heard that episode previously on Chat 10 Looks 3, Crab loved this documentary series on Netflix called Chef's Table. I watched a few episodes. It's absolutely, completely brilliant. And it basically profiles chefs of Michelin-starred restaurants around the world. But it does it in such a unique way, you know, you get this really great access to their backstory. Anyway,
beautifully shot. Like
absolutely.
The cinematography is just superb.
Episode number two is Dan Barber, who is the sort of originator of the farm to table movement.
Mad genius.
Was running a farm and a restaurant called Blue Hill Farm in New York.
Don't like the name. I never like the word blue around food. I very rarely will eat at a place that has blue in the name.
Don't you think Blue Hill is a lovely lyrical?
Just don't want my food to be blue. I think I get this from Wendy Sharp.
Do you not like blueberries?
Cookbook author. She can't stand blue anywhere near food. Like, and I think I've just got it from her.
What, like you wouldn't eat blueberries or?
I think she'd eat blueberries, but she wouldn't eat them from a blue plate. But a blueberry's not really blue anyway, is it? It's a sort of deep purpley colour.
Yeah. Well, that's just weird. You guys are freaks.
Yeah, but I think maybe I've got to that point where we've been friends for so long and she's had that particular tick for so long that
I've got it now too
and I just don't know. And so I seriously just went, Blue Hill Farm.
All right, let's call it Yellow Hill Farm so that you can feel comfortable with the story.
Orange Hill Farm.
Green
Hill Farm would be better, actually. It just sounds more green.
But then that's tautological. It'd just be Hill Farm.
No, but what if it's brown? If it's summer, it'd be Brown Hill Farm.
Brown Hill, because that sounds way more appetizing than Blue Hill.
Why don't we just call it shit sandwich and be done? Sorry.
So I watched this episode.
How many times can I interrupt this story
I really want to punch the other ass cheek of yours and just give you a matching set.
There is a square inch of my ass that remains.
If you're wondering what I'm talking about, please listen to the previous episode. So I watched this episode. I would say that it is the type of eating and food around which I'm fairly skeptical, which is that he was serving up stuff that to me looked like a raw carrot, like a raw plate of raw vegetables that is Michelin starred. And then the reviewers, you know, the best food critics in the world would go, oh, it's like I've never eaten a carrot before. It's the world's most amazing carrot. Mm. And so I just thought, I was so curious, like, well, how good can a carrot actually be?
Yeah.
Like that you feel like you've never eaten a carrot before. And also he was just this singularly intense, obsessive guy.
Wow. And the way that they shot that episode also really just so skillfully touched up his obsessiveness, but not in a kind of crass way, but like, so there's these shots of him running through the hills around this blue farm. And God, doesn't stack up. And and you just get this sense of this compulsive personality.
Well, same sort of person who's driven to do long distance running, you know, that's his guy's personality. He looks nothing like most people that you see who are chefs. He's like lean, like, you know, that sort of over-exercise
really
look.
Hard-bodied sort of Julie Bishop type.
So I just found it so intriguing that I felt like I have to go there and I have to eat that food.
And that is why
he
participated in the series.
I want to know myself. So I roped in my friends Nikki, Alex and Grace, who were all in New York, and I said to them, look, I might be signing us up to a $50 raw carrot, okay? And so I just want to put that right out there because I want this to be clear that it's a bit of an experiment. And at least if we are signed up to that, it's going to be a good New York story, okay? Yeah. So let's all be aware of that. And I made them all watch the doco. And then
did you get them to sign anything? Wow, night out with you sounds like fun.
Like a release form. Like, you know.
Did it have to end at 9:30 like most of your normal nights out?
Well, here's a happy coincidence. So Blue Hill is so popular that they only take bookings 1 month ahead.
Right.
And they open them, you know, at a certain time, which for us, luckily, happened to be the middle of the day Australian time. So me and Nikki sat on our computers the second it was there, bang, and Nikki got through, and but all we could get was 5 p.m. 5 p.m. tables before.
And you're just like, this is the best day ever already.
So here we are, you know, 29th of December. We've got our booking at Blue Hill. So we arrive. It's on
Did you go to the Manhattan one?
The Manhattan one, yeah. So there's one in Greenwich Village in Manhattan. So it's on West 4th Street in Greenwich Village. It's just a very nondescript front with Blue Hill written in very small letters. When you walk
in... Blue lettering?
No. It's not – nothing's that – nothing would be that obvious about it. When you walk in, the woman who's like the maitre d' was just amazing, like beautiful short silver hair, this brocade sort of three-quarter length jacket. She looked amazing. The whole restaurant has – it's extremely elegant and everything's perfect, but it's subtle. It's not in any way trying hard. There was two – floral displays which sort of evoke country flowers or cottage garden, but not in a, again, not in a try hard way, like we're really pushing the farm theme. So the look of it was all, it was soft greys and it was beautiful. And again, just that sort of attention to detail that only a really intense personality could bring to it. And then the food, the best way I can describe it is, it was like, and like I said, I'm sort of skeptical of this type of stuff. It was like I went to up the magic faraway tree and got to the land at the top, and the land at the top was the best version of every bit of ordinary food that you've ever tasted in your life.
Right, okay.
It truly was amazing.
So what was the first thing that came out?
They just put – so you ordered three courses, but then they brought other little things as well. So the first thing that came out, which they just plonk out, was four raw radishes.
Right.
They were delicious. They were absolutely
– so just plonked on a plate or
– plonked on a plate, no dressing, just plonked on a plate. And they were just – the slightest hint of pepper, but beautiful and juicy and just delicious.
Whole, like with the green bit as well?
Yep, with the green bit, so you just left the end. Then the next thing they brought out again, which was not something you'd ordered, was a slice of kohlrabi.
Oh.
Your favourite. This is what I really wish you were there.
This is getting great.
With some shaved hazelnut on top of it. I don't know how you shave the hazelnut. Again, it just tasted like
I leave my hazelnuts hairy.
Beautiful, crisp, delicious, yummy thing. Then
so just kohlrabi with shaved hazelnut.
That's it. That was it. And it was like, it's so hard because I don't have the food language that a food writer would have to explain how delicious this
was. What
was
the mouthfeel of the kohlrabi? I will never forgive the food writing establishment.
Almost sort of like an apple.
Right.
Like, yeah. Just delicious.
Never understood why people cook kohlrabi. It's so good raw.
It was great.
I blame the Hungarians.
Then, I wish I'd written down what everyone else ordered, but for my starter, I had Brussels sprouts with grapes in it.
Oh, wow.
Beautiful.
Vegetarian?
No, it's not vegetarian. Right. I had venison for my main, also beautiful. Somebody else had chicken. The other two people for their entree had a thing that was called on the menu Merry Christmas. It was a bit of Romanesco, which is...
Oh, yeah. Oh, Romanesco is just the most fabulous vegetable.
So it's like a cauliflower or a broccoli or something, right?
But
in that family?
It's got this crazy fractal pattern.
Well, it was sliced into a slice that looked like a Christmas tree. Oh, I took a photo.
Yeah.
The only dish I took
That's
a photo
the shape
of.
That it is.
And
they're
then
really
there
hard
was...
to get in Australia, but they're the most fabulous vegetable. And you can roast them whole. Like
That's how it was done, I think. Or actually, maybe it wasn't. Maybe it was steamed. But anyway, there was a white sauce with cranberries in it. So you had that sort of Christmas green, red.
Yeah.
And then there was two little gold leaf packages, looked like little presents that had a cheese in them.
Oh, wow.
It was delicious. And it looked, when it came on the table, we all went, oh, wow. Like it looked fantastic as well. The food all looked really delicious too. It wasn't like, you know, some high-end restaurants, they look sort of clever and a bit that molecular gastronomy look doesn't look very tasty to me. The food all looked inviting and nice. Mm. And you never for one second felt like I'm not getting it or I'm not cool enough or whatever. And then, main, I had venison. Dessert was like a poached pear with a sort of cream and some maple stuff and blah, blah, blah. But then the last thing that they put on the table was an apple. And it was again, it wasn't something you ordered. They just brought it out. It was a type of apple I've never heard of, which was a snapdragon apple. Mm. And it was just still in the apple corer with like all the slices just hanging out. And it had some roast strawberries that had a maple sugar on them dotted on it as well, which were nice. But the apple, I swear to God, it was the greatest apple I've ever eaten in my life. It was so beautiful and juicy and delicious, and the noise of it when you crunched into it, it was just the most, like, makes you want to cry, perfect apple. The other thing was, because of course the carrot was also what I wanted to try. So the main meal, one of the others got, it's called a carrot steak. Mm. So it's basically the carrot comes out and it is cooked, but it's a whole carrot.
Yeah.
I would guess it was roasted. And it, I had a bite of hers. It did taste, I mean, I'm not going to say it was the best carrot I've ever had, like the apple definitely was, but it was a really, the only way I can describe it, it was like super intense carrot. It was like carrot on steroids. It was like almost like the essence of 20 carrots in one carrot.
Wow.
It was, the whole experience was beautiful and just satisfying in every possible way. Like,
wow.
It was like going to a great, I felt like that is something completely unique and great, and I loved it. Absolutely loved it.
One man's compulsive disorder basically is.
And incredible, because the reason I keep saying like that I'm a skeptic of this type of stuff, because I always think, oh, it's a bit of a wank, like how delicious can an apple actually be, you know, really, we're going to pay $26 for that carrot? Like, it truly was amazing and unique and interesting, and I didn't feel remotely let down. I just felt like I got more of an insight into what an unbelievable perfectionist and intense character that guy must be able to make food like that.
Oh, I'm so pleased that worked out.
Oh, it was, I really recommend it if you ever find yourself there, to try to get a table, because it was just a really great experience. I loved it. And so then on the plane on the way home, I watched, because you've talked about Dominique Krenn, who's another
from Atelier Krenn, which is in San Francisco.
Her episode's on a different season of Chef's Table, but you've been talking about her for a while, so I watched that one as well. And again, oh, what an incredible personality. Just sort of not, she was intense, but in a way, different way to him.
Yeah.
And just the creativity around the food and the ideas. And
I think what that series does, I reckon, is that it really makes it clear that the people who are at the absolute top of that game, because you sort of think, well, cooking, you know, it's about learning how to do things and how to, you know, put things together and, you know, and plate them up to look beautiful. But what's really clear after you watch a few of these Chef Tables things is that the same things that make a filmmaker great, or that make a writer great, or even that make an actor great, all the things that have happened to them in their lives, all of these sort of personality quirks that they have, instead of trying to flatten out, indulged and pursued, even when other people think that they're crazy, that is what makes these people great. And it's a really great and well-shot reminder of that, that cooking at that level is an art form that is also interacts with all these other art forms. I mean, that one with Massimo Bottura, like, makes it really clear that his cooking only really became spectacular when he met his wife, who introduced him to visual art, which he really responded to in a way that completely changed and enhanced the way that he cooked.
I reckon I've watched probably half a dozen episodes of that now. The other thing too that really strikes me is how often they talk about making a story with their food, whether they're pushing, you know, like buttons to do with nostalgia or childhood or evoking a country or a place or whatever, that they are attempting to, like, as you say, with a piece of art, they're making a sort of story and an emotional response. They're not just dishing up something that's delicious to eat. But, you know, hopefully the thing that with the Massimo Bottura episode that I found so amazing was that everything that they dished up at his restaurant, I just thought, that looks so delicious. Yeah. Like, it looked high-end, but it also looked absolutely delicious.
But he's trying to evoke something like that, the famous dish of his called the crunchy part of the lasagna, which is this kind of deconstructed crunchy cheese. And, like, he's trying to recreate the corner bit of the lasagna that he would always go for to steal from his grandmother's plate of lasagna. Like, let's stop pretending that the best bit isn't the burnt bit at the end that everybody wants, you know. And the whole story he tells about that is, it's extraordinary. And also, like, these guys are often responding to some privation or something in their childhood that's made them go searching for things. And, like, that's the thing about the Dominique Krenn. You know, she was adopted as a child with her brother, and so she never knew her birth parents. And you get this sort of feeling as you're watching it that she's built this whole restaurant, which is about nostalgia and about finding your roots and about telling stories. And you think, wow, have you sort of built this for your parents that you didn't meet? Like, it's,
well, that's interesting because the restaurant's actually named after her adoptive father.
She was very close to her father.
Anyway, it's a great series, and that, and just also my three friends that I roped in loved it too.
Oh, good.
So that's
thank
like
God.
A good
that could be
everyone
an
who
cab
went,
ride home.
Yeah, really, really thought it was something pretty special. Do you, I've been talking about being in a bit of a reading slump.
Yeah.
So I got back on the reading horse when I was on holidays. Yep. Wouldn't necessarily say I'm out of my reading slump, but I think I am.
I'm out of my film slump, by the way. There's about 10 movies that I want to see right now.
That by the Churchill thing. Do you, for a holiday read, like, what do you look for in a holiday read, and is it any different to what you would look for in a regular read?
Oh, very different.
Yeah, same.
So if I take nonfiction, I want it to be a nonfiction that I just know that I'm going to love. Like, I don't really want to work hard to squeeze things out of a book that is about something that I'm not instantly interested in. If I want to, a holiday read has got to be an easy read, I think, that indulges you in some way. So I took on holidays the new collection of Martin Amis's
nonfiction
writing.
Yeah.
And, like, it is, yeah, it's so good. I mean, he has his things that he returns to time and time again, and this collection reflects that. But, in fact, the best analysis of his nonfiction writing is actually on the back sleeve. It reflects exactly what I think about it, and it is written by Rachel Cusk. I know, right?
Wow.
She's just our other favourite number one lady at the moment. And she writes, Amis is as talented a journalist as he is a novelist, but these essays all manifest an unusual extra quality, one that is not unlike friendship. He makes an effort. He makes readers feel that they're the only person there. And I think that's really true. I mean, I'm sure that Martin Amis in real life is probably a bit of a shit, but his, you know, it is generous. The way that he writes is never lazy. There's always so much packed in. You learn a lot, but it's also it's phrased with such elegance that sometimes you just laugh with delight as you read something. And I don't find that with his fiction at all. I used to, like, I went through a phase of really loving Martin Amis's fiction, but really I have read no fiction of his that I've loved in the last probably 15 years, to be honest.
Maybe I should read this collection because the last thing I tried to read of his was actually London Fields, and I couldn't get into it.
I love London Fields, but it's so out of date now, London Fields as well. But the best thing, the bit that just made me clap, and rather awkwardly, it's actually Martin Amis writing about how novelists can sometimes just go off. And he writes really, like, he doesn't refer to himself in this sense because he's still a very successful novelist, obviously. I mean, maybe I've stopped
Is thinking of himself though? But anyway,
I mean, it's impossible not to. I mean, like, in this essay, he kind of talks about the inevitability of novelists sort of going off. Yeah. And he talks about, this essay is about Nabokov, and, you know, he basically goes through, well, which books of Nabokov's are truly great and which are just shit, and why does he go on about underage girls all the time? Like, he's quite hard on Nabokov, even though he's clearly in love with him. But this reassured me so much, right? He says, I've read at least half a dozen Nabokov novels, at least half a dozen times, and at least half a dozen times I have tried and promptly failed to read Ada. My first attempt took place about 3 decades ago. I put it down after the first chapter with a curious sensation, a kind of negative tingle. Every 5 years or so, this became the pattern. I picked it up again, and after a while, I began to articulate the difficulty. But this is dead, I said to myself. The curious sensation, the negative tingle, is of course miserably familiar to me now. It's the reader's response to what seems to happen to all writers as they overstep the biblical span. The radiance, the life-giving power begins to fade. Last summer, I went away with Ada and locked myself up with it, and I was right. At 600 pages... 2 or 3 times Nabokov's usual fighting weight, the novel is what homicide detectives call a burster. It is a waterlogged corpse at the stage of maximal bloat. Oh, isn't that so great?
Do you
see what I mean? There's so much reflection in those couple of paragraphs. And also I loved it because I've tried to read Ada a bunch of times. I'm just like, I just don't like this. I'm just, am I too stupid for this novel?
That is so good. I wonder also at what point did Martin Amis hear the term burster, which I've never heard, and think I am just going to file that away because that's going to be useful to describe something that is fantastic. Because also, I've never read that novel, I've never attempted to, and yet now that he's described it like that, I know exactly what that book must be like.
I know. Oh, anyway, I've already underlined hundreds of things in this
book. Oh, that's
fantastic.
But
yeah, I think that I am just absolutely ready now just to only read nonfiction by Martin Amis and really enjoy it. And, you know, there'll be bits that I won't like. But so this book's broken up into a whole lot of kind of sections, and there's a lot about his literary figures that he writes a lot about ordinarily. So Saul Bellow, Nabokov, Philip Larkin, a little bit about Christopher Hitchens, who is of course his great friend. But he also writes a lot of stuff about politics. So because he lives now in the States, there's a bunch of really good essays about the Trump campaign, about the Mitt Romney campaign, which is very perceptive, funny, sharp, brutal. It's just him at his best, I think. And John Travolta gets a few essays. So he's kind of, and he writes about the time he went and played celebrity poker in Las Vegas. So there's one about the House of Windsor that I'm looking forward to. So it's a real mix of things. But he's great at high culture and low culture, which is what makes him so great in this format. I'm loving it.
So The Rub of Time.
It's called
Martin
The Rub of
Amis.
Time. Incidentally, the cover photograph that Martin Amis has selected for the front shows him being really unrubbed by time. It's a much younger shot, right?
And a very handsome
it's
shot.
It's a very
of
handsome
Martin
brooding,
Amis.
You know. Yes. It's taken around about the time that he was seeing to great Germaine Greer, I think.
Well, interestingly, it says, you know, 1986 to 2016, but I'm calling that shot as pre-86.
Oh, totally, yeah. It's really funny because I remember once reading an essay by him about interviewing Truman Capote, which is a great interaction. It appears in the collection called The Moronic Inferno, which is a really good collection. I think I've talked about before, but he concentrates quite a bit on like the cover photo that or the jacket photo that Truman Capote selected for In Cold Blood, which is like where he looks like this incredible pretty boy, and it attracted a lot of comment at the time. And he asks Capote about it. He says, I didn't even choose that. It was something that was just they picked out of the drawer.
I used to love that on one of Sean McAuliffe's shows, I forget which one, this was quite a few back now, they had a publicity shot of him, like, you know, hey, when you walk through the ABC Foyer, there's a giant photo of everyone. He's had his eyes shut, like as if they'd just chosen the one bad shot of him to actually use.
That's very McAuliffe.
Hey, you mentioned Rachel Cusk.
I did.
One of the books,
so let's talk.
I read Aftermath.
So did
on holidays. Okay, I had a few problems with it. I didn't like it as much as Transit and
Neither
Outline.
Neither did I.
Oh, interesting. Mm. Okay, that's good to know. So the bit that sort of I found puzzling, so it's unfolding basically as a straight first-person narrative, not clear if it's really fiction or non-fiction, about
this
the aftermath of her marriage.
This is sort of the first book that Rachel Cusk wrote that made her sort of notorious. Oh, she wrote one about having children that made her a bit notorious. But this is basically an account of her marriage breakdown.
But is it meant – well, sorry, I was going to say, is it meant to be fiction or non-fiction? But it gets to a point about two-thirds of the way through where it suddenly shifts from being a first-person, fairly straightforward read – shifts into a third person thing about two characters called Sonia and Kurt, who you have had nothing to do with previously.
Yeah.
And to me, it just felt like someone had just ripped on the handbrake. And I was like, who are these people? And what? What was that about?
But don't you think it was, I thought that same thing. So it's this incredibly intimate and searing, rending account of a marriage breakdown, right? So there's the protagonist, a woman who's separated from her husband. We don't really meet the husband except she talks, you know.
It's not really clear why.
It's basically
either.
Well, she's got a lot of sort of borderline Freudian explanation for it that she discussed with her therapist. But like it's basically her being in the aftermath of a marriage breakdown, and she's talking about how she's moving through her life and how she's struggling to
She wants to be busted up with the marriage, but she struggles to sort of be single. You know, she shows up at places and it's just her and her two kids, and she feels like everyone else is in a couple. And she just sort of struggles, I guess, with being alone.
Than that it is. What is marriage, and to what extent does it constitute, you know, who you are? And then
that part of it was all great.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
So, and she's got two daughters, and part of it is her, I suppose, reforming the way that she looks at them and that she relates to them now that they are her two children that aren't part of this sort of family.
And she talks quite a bit about how prior to the marriage breakup, she would have said, well, the mother and father are equally responsible for the children. And then she was shocked to hear herself say in a meeting at the lawyers, they're mine.
Yeah.
They're my children. Like, I will have primary responsibility.
It's a lot about her. She spends a lot of time talking about what being a woman is and what being a man is, and that her transgression had been to be the man in this relationship. And, like, anyway,
I thought that was great.
There are patches of brilliance in it, but I think a lot of it, like, some of it is a bit over.
It's overwrought
is exactly the word. And so it's really interesting reading that earlier book of hers, when I think she's just reached such greater heights with both Transit and Outline, which we both read and enjoyed. And this is like, it's like the plaster dummy that, you know, she messed around with before she did those books. Like, because there are some similar themes, but they're so much more intricately and sophisticatedly evoked in the later books than they are. Like, there's a scene where it's her mother's birthday, mother lives in the country, so she makes this cake for her mother and it doesn't really work and it's a failure, and it was meant to be so beautiful and gracious, and actually it's all just doughy and sort of rubbery and it looks like a crazy person's cake. And then she drives out there with the cake in the back seat with the two children, and then she arrives and they're setting up trestle tables, and there's so many people in the family, they haven't got enough tables, so they've got these rough, differently matched tables, but then you throw the cloths over the top and all of a sudden all of these floors are hidden. Like, it's that sort of thing. Like, it's a bit obvious.
Yeah.
But what you're talking about that happens later on, all of a sudden there's this woman, Sonia, who seems to be moving to a strange house in a strange country, and she's on the phone to her sort of boyfriend, Kurt, who's in the country that she comes from. It's never quite sure which, but it's a European country and she's clearly moved to England. But then as you read, it's clear that she's come to be an au pair in a family, a mother and a father and two daughters who then split up. So
that's what... That's what I took it to be, that she was now the first person, that the protagonist.
Yeah.
This is her au pair, right? It was – I just thought the device of switching to the third person and leaving you to struggle for about 25 pages to make that – draw that conclusion. And I thought, is this the fig leaf of, oh, it's fiction. It's fiction. That's what it left me with. And it just – it annoyed me. Oh, really? I got so intensely annoyed. I finished it and just went, well, what was that? It was really annoying.
Like, because it took me a while to get the epiphany where I'm like, oh, okay, so this is the family, because it's, I guess, the rest of the book is such a supercharged work of introspection. It's almost, it hurts your head. Like, you are in this woman's head. And even the extent to which she talks about her daughters and her ex-husband, it is absolutely all viewed from inside this woman's cranium. And there is something so intense about that that you also get in some of her other novels, but it is overwrought. But then I actually found that shift once I kind of worked out what was going on, and it probably took me about 10 pages for the penny to drop and, oh, right, okay, so we're looking at this from a different angle. I thought it was an okay decision.
But then I felt like if you're going to do that, and that's a perfectly fine decision to do that, well, then why would you not then rejig the rest of it to be not first person?
You would ruin the whole device.
Why would you, for that device, introduce some other characters to give that external perspective as well, instead of just this bolt-on in the final?
Because then you don't get that sense of building that you get. You know, it's so intense that by the end of the bit that's the narrative from the mother, you feel like you're completely suffused by her and her views on herself, and like it's suffocating. But then what you get next is a view that is so strange that you don't even recognize the woman, because you don't recognize her from outside herself, because you only know her from the inside.
Yeah.
And suddenly you've got this other figure who's actually undergoing quite a lot of trauma in her own life. And the glimpses that you get of the woman are so one-dimensional, you know, but you can see that these are two worlds of trauma that are jostling next to each other. I thought it was, I mean,
don't mind that. The idea of that device, I felt that it didn't work in the execution.
Yeah.
And the character was so far in their own headspace that I was just thinking for the husband, geez, mate, you've dodged a real bullet here. You should be glad that you saw the back end of this.
Well, I mean, it does really raise the question. I deliberately, with all of these Rachel Cusk novels, you know, normally if I read something that's quite personal, like I'll start looking around for features or like a bit more information about how much of it is true, you know, is that what is this person really like? But I've never done that with Rachel Cusk because I want to read the books first, because she's so intense and so clever and so, I mean, there's so much gorgeous structure to those later books. Mm. It's so elegant and funny as well. So, yeah, it's funny in those two later books are funny in a way that Aftermath just like it isn't. It's just so grim.
Yeah, it's more the other two were just packed with insight. And this one, I mean, look, maybe also I brought my expectations were too high because I'd found the others so amazing. Yeah. So I was just like, oh, geez.
Yeah. No, but it's definitely
I just Google image searched her because I wanted to see what she looked like, but I won't tell you.
We should jointly Google.
Hey, I got to go to a meeting.
Yep.
So I better disappear.
Great. Okay.
Save all your other thoughts for later.
Yeah. God, we always just stretch things out. We just talked about carrots for 35 minutes, really, basically, didn't we? Sorry, everybody.
And I loved it.
Next week, another vegetable.
Bye.
Bye.